Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, energy, and our environment right here coming out of your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we are here, joined here by three guests as we kind of take a look at where we are going nationally with the environment and energy, food policy, and more under this new presidential regime. We are here with Tom Philpott, food and agricultural correspondent for Mother Jones, Janet Redman, who is policy director at Oil Change International, a research communication advocacy group focused on exposing the true cost of fossil fuels and facilitating the coming transition towards clean energy, and Bashaf Sen, who is the director of Climate Policy Project Institute, director of Climate Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Bashaf, Janet, Tom, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888 by phone. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, wherever you're listening to us from. Whatever the most inexpensive way is to join us, 410-319-8888. So let me just begin. Janet Redman, it's good to have you back in the air with us, and congratulations once again on your new position at Oil Change International.
Thank you so much. It's
good
to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So we'll go on the table, but start with you. So the latest pronouncements with the budget of that Donald Trump announced, what will be the effects on climate change policy, do you think? I mean, what can you glean from this?
What we're seeing are huge rollbacks in the direction we had been going, which is moving toward clean energy expansion. So this budget really reflects a dirty energy fossil fuel expansion. I think what folks had been hearing before the budget was released turned out to be true. We're seeing a 31% cut in the EPA's budget. We're seeing 28% cut in the State Department budget, which of course is part of how we relate internationally around climate change and energy policy. The things that I've been most concerned by was what was missing. So, for example, the past 8 budgets, President Obama has suggested eliminating $38 billion over 10 years in fossil fuel subsidies. That eliminating those fossil fuel subsidies would have saved taxpayers $4.2 billion this year alone, in 2018. And instead, what we see is Donald Trump saying, actually, let's cut $4.2 billion from the budget through things like cutting Meals for Wheels programs for elderly citizens, cutting services for disabled Americans, taking away LIHEAP, which is a low-cost energy affordable heating program for low-income Americans. So, and we're seeing a push toward expanding exploration and extraction of fossil fuels on public lands, and of course, more broadly, a rollback of regulations around exploring and extracting more fossil fuels in our public lands and waters. So I think we're combined with review of vehicle emission standards, we're seeing a real situation of moving off of a clean energy track, which of course means bad things for our environment, but bad things for the American public, our health, our economic viability moving forward as well.
So I want to come back to this, the things you raised, and kind of really talk about what these would mean for us. And Tom Philpott, talk about your observations and the others that you work with about what Trump's announcements might mean for food and energy and more.
Well, the massive 31% cut to the EPA is really, really pinching an agency that is already way, way over committed and not only just in climate terms, but also in terms of things like testing chemicals before they go out into the environment, holding companies to high standards for those chemicals, and, you know, making sure that they're safe before they happen. And then I'm also seeing a rather substantial cut to the USDA's discretionary spending budget of $4.7 billion. And so that wouldn't come out of things like the SNAP program that is not discretionary, but it would come out of things like food safety. As you know, Mark, that the USDA is the agency that ensures the safety of the meat system. So they do all the inspections of these, you know, giant meat slaughterhouses. And so that would be a direct pinch on that. And I think we're going to see more of that because the meat industry has been in favor of rolling back USDA inspections, and now we have a president and a USDA director who would probably support that. And so, you know, what we're seeing here is what was promised, which is a full-on attack on the regulatory state. And we're seeing the budget version of it right now. And, you know, the scary part, of course, is that the Congress is, as it is right now, is going to be welcoming these budget cuts for sure. So I don't really see how they're stopped.
So I'm going to come back to that point as well, about stopping or not stopping, how you do that. And Basav Sen, your thoughts on what you're seeing. And by the way, let me congratulate you on your new position as Director of Climate Policy at IPS. But please, what are you seeing?
Thank you for inviting me on this show. So I'm going to name what I see as the two underlying motivations for the Trump administration's actions on climate and the environment and their actions more broadly. The two lenses through which I view a lot of their activities are, number one, racism, white supremacy, and number two, crony capitalism. And let me explain a little bit.
Go ahead.
One thing that this administration has done in their EPA budget proposal is zero out the budget for environmental justice. It took low-income communities and communities of color decades of struggle against the government, against corporations, and even against well-meaning but clueless environmentalists to get them all to acknowledge that people of color and poor people have played, you know, they have paid a disproportionate price for the polluting ways of corporate America. And this belated acknowledgement led to the creation of the Environmental Justice Program at EPA, which over the years has provided small but regardless meaningful grants to communities who've been struggling with some of these disproportionate harms. And they have provided some good data on their website as well about environmental justice issues. And that budget has been zeroed out.
Right.
And that is nothing short of pandering to racists. To say that, oh, this is not important. We have to see that also in conjunction with the administration's decision to go ahead with the Dakota Access Pipeline. Now, I should point out that the Obama administration were not exactly perfect either. It took an epic struggle on the part of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation with allies from all over to reverse the decision and halt the pipeline. And this administration comes in and restarts it right away. And the message is, we do not care about the environment, we do not care about the future of humanity, and we do not care about people of color. And let me come to the second point, which is crony capitalism. Certain favored businesses, namely large fossil fuel companies, the ExxonMobils and Kinder Morgans of this world, have a lot of clout within this administration. And this is not merely an issue of being pro-business, because there are a lot of, you know, solar installers and wind energy companies, etc., out there. Who are also businesses. Rather, this is crony capitalism because it favors certain large and politically influential sectors of business, the ones who have partially bankrolled the political career of people like Scott Pruitt and Rick Perry. So that's the lens through which I view this administration's actions. It's racism and it's crony capitalism.
So let me pick up on that point. And these are all, you all made really very critical points. And I want to start with the environment and energy questions and come to the question of food safety as well, because I think that these are very critical. So, Jenna, let me again start with you. I mean, so so talk about what you think the consequences are going to be here. That I want to, before we end the conversation, we're going to talk about what the political struggle means to combat this and how we defend the environment, defend communities of color, and defend our the advancements in food and agriculture. But what are the consequences here from your perspective?
The consequences are pretty clear in what we see in the budget, what's named in the budget itself. So we've only seen pretty broad brushstrokes for each of the different agencies and main federal programs out there. But we're seeing targeting of, for example, expansion of the Fossil Energy Research and Development Program. We're seeing the U.S. Geological Service being given money to expand their research and development on public lands of energy production, at the same time as we're seeing cuts in things like the weatherization program, cuts in advanced technology vehicle manufacturing programs, so moving to cleaner vehicles. I think what we're really seeing clearly is a move away from what the Trump administration is calling "quote unquote" duplications and programs that they think could be covered at the state level or through other programs. But that includes things like services for seniors and services for children, educational services, et cetera, around the environment and energy, and instead saying we're going to kick that to the state agencies to decide for themselves. So I think we're going to see a huge shift then, of course, in the number of people who are staffing these agencies. When we have a cut in budget, that means we have a cut in full-time employees also. That means implementation of some of the rules that have been on the books for a long time, and we've been struggling to have them enforced, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. We'll see less and less enforcement of these really critical provisions at the same time as we're seeing some of the regulations themselves being attacked. So it's kind of like an attack from two different directions on our energy infrastructure and environmental protections. And again, the implications are on people's public health. These are the kinds of agencies and the rules that are keeping people from, I think as I mentioned, from being poisoned by their food, from being poisoned by the water they drink, coming out of their tap potentially, being poisoned by the air they breathe because they're surrounded by polluting facilities, but also polluting vehicles, et cetera. So the implications are really going to be on people's health and people's lives, and I think BASF makes a really good point. In particular, those are going to be the lives of low-income folks and folks of color, because that's where a lot of polluting infrastructure exists today, and where the expansion of, for example, fossil fuel infrastructure would likely reside. So it's a huge impact on Americans' health and on our environment.
So, Tom Philp, I mean, it's the part of the picture that Janet Redmond's painting to me is a pretty frightening picture about what we might expect in these coming months and perhaps even years.
Yeah, and so I think one thing that we would agree on is that what we need right now in both our food system and in our energy system is we need this transformation. We need the business as usual is polluting the environment. It's not taking care of people. And in terms of the food system, you know, we have all these diet-related diseases and massive, massive pollution of water from agriculture that isn't even taken care of by the Clean Water Act. There's all these major problems. And then you add climate change to the mix, which is going to be a crucial problem going forward for food production, and food production contributes to it, and it's also affected by it. So we need to be, you know, steering the ship in a new direction, and what this administration is doing and its congressional allies is, literally plunging their foot onto the gas and moving it in the same old direction of injustice, massive pollution, and bringing on climate chaos. And so, in the big picture, that's the tragedy here. You know, we don't have that much time to avoid what could be catastrophic climate change, and we're looking at, you know, at least four, and God forbid, eight more years of moving in the wrong direction. And I think that's what is, in a big picture way, really, really sad here.
And so picking up on that, I'm going to come back to some food safety issues because I don't want to leave here without talking a bit about them and what that the other devastating effect that could have on the health of our community and our people. But so, Basav, let's begin. And Jenna, please chime in. All of you chime in. But what is our political reaction to all of this? I mean, clearly we're not folks, and I think most communities of color, most communities who are standing up around this country, most of us who have been standing up for a long time, we're not going to just lie down and take this. So, Basav, let's talk a bit about what the reaction needs to be and what you think it will be.
Yes, and I have a lot of hope, surprisingly. One is an issue that I've been actually working on in my, at this point, 4 weeks at IPS. I'm working on a report.
Right.
Looking at what states and cities are doing all over the country to combat climate change on their own. Because if the federal government not just refuses to act, but intends to take America backward, so much for making America great again, there's a lot that cities and states can do and have done. I'll just point out a few examples. Hawaii will be 100% renewable energy for their electricity by 2045. The state of Oregon will completely eliminate coal from their electricity supply by 2030. Right here in the District of Columbia, we will be 50% renewables for our electricity supply by 2032. And simultaneously with that, solarize 100,000 low-income homes by then. That's the city's renewable energy goals. And these are the kinds of things that states and cities are doing all over the country, and including in some so-called red states. I would like to point out what Austin, Texas is doing around composting and zero waste. Just because the federal government is so backwards, it doesn't mean we need to be in our cities and our states. That's number one. And number two, there is the power of organized popular resistance. Every time that people have made advances in this country or anywhere else in the world, it's because of pressure from below. It's because of popular pressure. That's what labor organizing in the 1930s and the civil rights movement in the 1960s accomplished. And that's what we can do moving forward. And I would like to point out that the climate and the environmental movement certainly needs to be very active, but cannot do this on their own. We have to think in cross-sectoral terms. We have to think outside our silos. We have to work alongside low-income communities and racial justice struggles and organized labor and so on and so forth. If we are to bring about the progressive shift that we want. And in a way, the election of Donald Trump has helped because it has sort of brought these issues into very sharp focus. And I see a certain politicization of people who formerly were not very engaged in the movement or in struggles for justice.
So
our numbers are going to grow, and we are going to become more powerful. I have a lot of hope.
That's one good way to start this conversation, Janet.
Yeah, I mean, just to jump off of there, I think that's exactly right. There's an incredible amount of local organizing that's happening, and those kind of just transition programs and projects that are happening that Basav mentioned. I think, you know, thinking about participatory budgeting at the local and sometimes state level experiments that are happening there are an interesting way to combat what we're seeing at the, you know, on the presidential budget level. But I think we don't want to lose sight of the fact that we need to hold these elected officials accountable in Congress. I mean, this budget doesn't just move as it is now. It has to get passed through Congress. And there's a chance to make sure we're doing everything we can to hold our elected officials accountable when they try to side with big oil, gas, and coal industry instead of with American workers and families. And so I'm hopeful that much of that organizing that's happening at the local level is also being concentrated and focused here in Washington, D.C. to ensure that these elected officials know that we're watching them and that we see how they vote, and we can also see what kind of contributions they receive from what industries. And as we know, Republicans get the majority of fossil fuel industry finance in contributions and lobbying dollars spent, but Democrats do as well. So this is a pretty critical time, I think, for us to be sending a message that those who call themselves progressive, those who call themselves climate champions, those who call themselves champions of the American working families, need to be making their votes around budgets and their proposals around budgets reflect that call. So I see a lot of room for both activity at the local level and at the federal level by making big stinks when people are home for recesses. But also I think running, I think it would be interesting to see how people start running electoral campaigns to challenge our decision makers on issues of taking money from the fossil fuel industry, on issues of really championing climate change and championing agencies like the EPA in this moment when they're under so much pressure.
So Tom, I mean, earlier in the program, you were talking about you're not sure what could happen next. What do you think about what the response can be?
Well, I think Janet and Basav both made excellent points. I mean, I think that we are in a position now where social movements become extremely important, both in terms of trying to influence elections, as Janet was saying, and also just getting out there on the street and making clear that this stuff is not acceptable and it's not going to be accepted by people, and it's going to become this increasing tension. I think we're going to have to ramp up the tension a lot to make changes here. And I think that one thing I think about a lot nowadays is that back in 2004, when George W. Bush was reelected, there was a lot of despair because, you know, there's a major push to, stop the war before it happened. It failed. Then there's a major push to defeat Bush and put someone in who promised to stop the war. And that failed. And, you know, suddenly, you know, here we are in 2005, the war is going on. And I think a lot of people got a little bit despairing of national politics and really started to focus on local issues. And I think there was this massive infusion of energy into the food movement at that time. And I think that, you know, you saw this big increase in farmers markets and people thinking about where their food comes from. And I think it was naive that time because a lot of it did not have an economic critique. It did not have a justice critique. And a lot of it was about sort of, you know, let's go shopping at the farmers market and have a nice time. And I think now, years later, I think that same kind of energy can happen again, but I think the food movement is a lot more sophisticated now. It's a lot more broad-based. There are a lot more diverse kinds of people in it, and I think that a similar kind of energy of organizing around food justice, I'm already seeing it start to happen again. I feel like it lost its energy a little bit as the Obama administration wore on, but I think it's now coming back with a vengeance. And that is just sort of figuring out not just personal preference and, my own personal virtue as a shopper, but figuring out new structures that make that work for farmers that aren't using a lot of chemicals, that work for consumers that maybe don't have a lot of money. I think there's a lot of hope around that. To speak nothing of, I think we're going to see a broader-based movement around climate. I think the, recent pipeline controversies and, the massive social movement pushback on those two recent pipelines, I think that is only planting seeds for more dissent around climate going forward. Mm-hmm. So from a social movement perspective, I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, I just think people need to get out in the street and primary non-progressive politicians and all that kind of stuff is the only response, is what I see.
So we have to take a very brief ID break and come right back to finish up our conversation with our three guests here, Tom Philpott, Janet Redmond, and Basav Sen. Don't go away. Stay with us, but do join us at 410-319-8888. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here, and we are going to continue our conversation with Janet Redmond, who's Policy Director for Oil Change International, Tom Philpott, Food and Agricultural Correspondent for Mother Jones, and Bassav Sen, who is Director of Climate Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and you at 410-319-8888. So as we conclude our conversation, I wanted to kind of just talk about the juxtaposition between what this cutting of budgets and opening the door to fossil fuels, challenging California's, which Trump will do, which could be an interesting battle to watch. Not sure what he can really do about their push for clean energy and clean cars, the danger of food safety and the future of our consumers here and the food that they eat. I mean, that's all going to be happening the time that this resistance keeps happening, Janet. I mean, this is a really very strange time, but also a time full of opportunity, but also full of real danger.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we are seeing, I think there are really deeply entrenched opposing forces, and they're getting more powerful. So I think you're right. You know, seeing something like Trump saying, we're going to go after the state of California for being bolder on climate change, being bolder on cleaner vehicles, and folks in the environment community and in California saying really clearly that's completely illegal and we will challenge you in the court. I think we're going to see a lot of this play out in court battles, which, to be perfectly frank, may be a really good compliment to the grassroots activism and state-level activism to slow down some of the most egregious and illegal actions that Trump is trying to take to thwart a clean energy revolution, to be perfectly honest. But I do think we are seeing those glimmers of hope. I think we'll continue to see the pockets, for example, of mayors who are taking pledges to say no fossil fuel expansion, no new fossil fuel infrastructure in my state. We'll continue to see, I spent last weekend with a number of folks from grassroots coalitions who are planning on, and the efforts to put our bodies in the way of pipeline build out and fight LNG exports. So I think what we'll see is really the folks that are left in these agencies, the people who are on the front lines of the bold proposals to take action, buckling in, staying strong, taking legal action, taking physical action to make sure that Trump's agenda doesn't move forward. And we all need to think about how we support that. If that's not happening in our community, let's start it. If we don't have that kind of infrastructure, how do we support it in other people's communities? But how do we not also forget the policy space and make sure we're pushing an offensive agenda that's saying, here's what we want. Here's the clean energy, clean jobs build out that we want at the community level, at the state level. We want programs that support that at the federal level. Because eventually, this administration will end. We need to have the infrastructure in place to get what we want when it's over, while we're fighting it every step of the way on a daily basis.
So, I was thinking what you were saying earlier, Tom Philpott. I'm going to talk about this in a moment. I mean, one of the things I thought of as you were talking about the cutbacks in food safety and all those programs that would take place at the USDA and other places, that this actually, this will really affect not just people who didn't vote for Trump or voted against him and voted for somebody else, but will affect Trump voters if tainted food starts hitting our marketplaces.
Of course. And let me give a concrete example that I was just writing about. And that is that that when you put a whole bunch of chickens together by the thousands in one of these factory chicken houses that you have a lot of over there in where you are, not too far. What you're doing is creating a great environment for the sort of mutation and generation of new forms of flu. And so we've got avian flu, not down where you are, but in Tennessee and Alabama, there's an avian flu that is going through these factory scale chicken farms. And in Asia, so the one here in the United States right now is not infecting humans, but this is a possibility. This is something that could happen. And there is a federal response to it. You get the USDA very closely tracking it, advising farms on how to stop it, they cull the chickens, i.e. kill them, and try to stop it in its tracks. You've got CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, working really hard to make sure that it doesn't infect humans, that all these kinds of safety measures are in place. And both of these agencies are looking down the barrel of steep budget cuts. And so this is something, this is sort of a federal Band-Aid on this problem that is very necessary. We need to be monitoring and figuring this out because, you know, one of these days, if you talk to researchers, you're going to get a flu that develops that has two properties. This is sort of a nightmare scenario. One, that it bounces from birds to humans. And then two, and that's already happening in Asia. There's an avian flu in Asia that does go from birds to humans. And then the second one that's not being in second condition, it's not being met in Asia yet, is that it then passes from human to human. And when you get that, you get a potentially really bad flu outbreak. And so you need these federal agencies in place doing their job, and we're now putting them under severe budget stress. And it wasn't like the USDA's discretionary money for this or CDC had these huge fat budgets. You know, we're not talking about very much money, but their budgets are now on the chopping block, and that is just pathetic, and that will affect Trump voters and non-Trump voters alike. And Trump himself, I mean, you know, a germaphobe in the White House.
Trump himself.
As much of a germaphobe as he is, he's certainly not protected from something like this.
Bas, a closing thought there from you.
Just building off of what Tom said, one thing that's really striking about the Trump administration's actions around not just energy and climate, but a lot of other stuff, is their disrespect for science. It's amazing how the U.S. government is now officially against science and scientists. So you're cutting scientific budgets for food safety and public health. You're cutting scientific research budgets for energy and environment and climate and for earth science, you know, geology, oceanography, atmospheric science, etc. And it's gone to the extent that it's politicized scientists. We're a very hard population to politicize, and I can speak personally to that since I'm a trained scientist. Scientists tend to be, you know, apolitical and wrapped up in their research. And the fact that scientists are going to be marching on the streets on April 22nd, Earth Day, you know, that says something about how extreme this administration's agenda is. But that, to me, just gives me more hope. And as Janet was saying, we have to fight their agenda in every forum that is available to us. We fight them in the courts, we fight them in legislatures, we fight them in policy spaces, we fight them on the street, we fight them in the media, you know, in the battle for the hearts and minds of the public, and we fight them in international forums. International forums around, for example, climate, where the U.S. is a signatory to international agreements, which, while non-binding, the agreement in Paris did not set binding commitments, but at the same time, they are public commitments that the U.S. government has made. And we certainly should use the opportunity to get foreign governments, to the extent that we can, to put the maximum possible pressure on the U.S. government to live up to their commitments and to expose the U.S. government for being what it is, for not just endangering the future of people in this country, but endangering the future of humanity and the planet as a whole in the service of short-term profit for a few people who are influential and powerful and give money to politicians here.
So what I want to thank the three of you, and this is we're going to come back to this with the three of you and others, but I'll let you all know that next Thursday we'll have an hour-long conversation with Mustafa Santiago Ali, who is the man who resigned from the head of environmental justice for the EPA. We're going to continue on this and continue to look at what the EPA did with $8 billion in their budget last year and what this means for the future. As we continue these conversations here on Soundbites, you just heard Bassav Sen, who is Director of Climate Policy Project for the Institute for Policy Studies, Janet Redman, Policy Director at Oil Change International, and Tom Philpott, Food and Agriculture Correspondent from Mother Jones. So Bassav, Janet, Tom, thank you three so much for this conversation. Look forward to getting you back on the air very soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank
Good
you very much.
Wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you all. I'm taking a short break, and we take a look at some more chicken news. Fried chicken. Don't go away. Back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, agriculture, and the environment and energy. And on our way to the conversation, I'll remind you that conversations like this are brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community to prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. So, it was a really interesting article in The Sun by one of our guests, Brittany Britto, who's in here in studio. Welcome, Brittany.
Thank you.
Who wrote Unpacking the Chicken Box, the story behind Baltimore's carryout staple that she put for The Sun. It was a really interesting article because it was more than just about the chicken box. It was about fried chicken itself. So it was really good to have you in the studio. And Dr. Psyche Williams-Forson joins us. She's author of Building Houses Out of Chicken Legs, Black Women, Food, and Power, associate professor and chair of the American Studies Program at the University of Maryland, College Park, who was featured in the article. And Psyche, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888, right to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. And when you do, if you want to bring us your thoughts and ideas about where you like to eat fried chicken and how you make your own. I was just saying before I went on the air, Brittany, how I love fried chicken. I know it's not the healthiest thing in the world. I do like it, but I make my own version of southern fried chicken, but I bake it.
It sounds very good.
It's really good. It tastes just as good, I think. But anyway, to talk a bit about what motivated this article and what you discovered.
So I've always been interested in culture. I am a foreign service brat, so I've moved around a lot. And every city seems to have their thing. And this story in particular kind of evolved from another story that I was writing about Baltimore language and kind of the differences in the white and black communities in Baltimore. And a term that was really popular here was chicken box. And so I kind of wanted to know what was the allure of the chicken box. You know, New York has the pizza, Philadelphia has the cheesesteaks, and even DC has fried chicken, but it's usually with the mumbo sauce. So I was wondering, you know, what is it about Baltimore's chicken box? And I also knew that different news organizations in the city have written about where to get the best chicken box.
Right.
So we wanted to leave it up to readers. So we put out a poll to see, you know, what they would vote for. And it was an open field poll, so they could write absolutely anything. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of tallied up the votes and found out where the best places were, and we wanted to visit, but we wanted to know how this came to be. So we started to dig into the history, which was really fun.
And part of the history, Dr. Williams-Forson, is really interesting because your book, which I really enjoyed, and talk a bit about the kind of, and I have one of these at home, the Negro Motorist Green Book. and kind of the history of why people packed what they packed and what are probably the roots of this chicken box.
Right. Well, you know, we were talking mostly around post-Reconstruction, and as African Americans began to travel throughout the U.S., north, south, east, west, you know, Jim Crow and Jim Crow laws as well as black codes were in effect, and so folks could not simply stop and eat where everyone else ate, and so it became a necessity and also a habit to pack one's own food. So that's pretty much how you get the origins, at least, of the shoebox lunch. And as I was explaining to Brittany, it could be a box, it could be a pail, a bag, whatever folks had. So it's interesting that the restaurants in Baltimore have taken on the actual shoebox because, or the actual box.
Right.
Because that, you know, is part of the folklore, actually.
It is interesting, because, I mean, you know, there was, because I guess many people of young generations don't remember nor realize that during the time of Reconstruction and segregation into the 1960s, black folks could not, I mean, you couldn't stop. You had to keep on rolling and maybe find a place to go to the bathroom, but you had to keep on rolling and couldn't buy any food, so it had to be packed this way. So, I mean, I guess most folks going about a chicken box, you know, that don't really, Brittany, think about the roots of, the powerful roots of why there's chicken boxes in Baltimore. And the Southern immigrants from the city, who live in the city, who brought that tradition with them to Baltimore.
Right. And I think also what's important to note, while we don't know exactly how it evolved, we still use or consume the chicken box in the same way. You know, it's very convenient. You can take it on the go. Adrian Miller, soul food scholar, and also Dr. Williams Forson have mentioned, you know, chicken carries very well. Fried chicken carries very well. It's good cold, if you've ever
right.
tried it that way. You know,
I love cold fried chicken.
it's definitely good hot. But, you know, these actual boxes allow you to take it wherever you want. So it kind of operates in the same vein. And what was also interesting is in the Baltimore Sun Archives in 1933, that was the earliest ad that we had that cited the chicken box. And when talking to Dr. Williams Forson, she kind of mentioned that kind of makes sense when you think about, you know, the Negro Motorist Green Book and where people could stop. That could have been a stop.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, right. Exactly. And one of the things I thought about as well, Dr. Williams Forson, is that there's a complex history here. So you have fried chicken of Mike Twitty, who comes on the show a lot, who is a food historian, is written about how fried chicken itself came out of many West African cultures, which were guinea fowls fried in peanut oil. Mm-hmm. That came to America and then translated into the way fried chicken was made on plantations and how it was usurped over the years in some really vile racist ways of selling fried chicken,
right.
And the complexity of that. Talk a bit about that, because I mean that's a piece of this for us to understand, I think.
Right. Well, in a nutshell, I mean, absolutely, I agree with Michael 100%. And you know, there are different studies that have been done. Origins are always difficult
right.
to pinpoint, you know, so I try to stay away from those. I just was sharing this with some folks the other day. I know Adrian says that the first recorded recipe for fried chicken is in a British cookbook, all of which is absolutely relevant and true. But African women had been frying chicken long before they came to this country, and so we can't assume that people came with no knowledge, right, of previous cultures. So once they got here to the, you know, New World, if you will, then folks did what they had to do to survive. And so they would not have had access to the same kinds of oils and so forth. But they were able to continue to use the cooking techniques that had been generational prior to this arrival in the U.S. And then, of course, we often forget slavery lasted several hundred years.
Right.
So by the time we get to the late 19th century, or just before emancipation, these practices have now been embedded in the American food culinary. So absolutely, one of the hidden stories here, Brittany, that we didn't talk too much about, is the role of women in passing on this sort of cultural practice. Mm. Because by and large, when folks were migrating, and I say this in building houses, often women could not go. They sent their children, they sent their husbands, they sent their partners, they sent their friends. But if they had children to tend to back home, if they had aged parents, they couldn't go. So part of what I argue is that the chicken then traveled in the place of these women.
Right.
So ultimately, we get not only a legacy of African-American culinary, but also a legacy of women in that process.
So I'm going to open the phones here and get folks in the conversation. So Clarence called in and left a message saying that he was from North Carolina and that he used to use a shoebox to pack food, chicken, et cetera, for long trips. And he thinks that's where the chicken box comes from. I couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to leave his comment about what happened when he was young traveling around the country from the South. 410-319-8888. Bill, you're on the air. Welcome.
Well, hello. How are you guys? I'm enjoying your conversation this morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Just wanted to share a story of my family. When we traveled down South, we would always leave 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. My mom would always pack us a lunch, consisted of bologna sandwiches, boiled eggs, and, of course, fried chicken. and that's the way we traveled. And even as we grew older and we went on fishing trips and things like that, she would always pack fried chicken in a box or a lunch box or whatever. But that is definitely a staple in our community. Mm. And also, the best fried chicken is always fried with lard.
Important to know.
And another comment that I wanted to make, when you talk about the chicken box in Baltimore, you cannot help but to mention a jumbo half and half.
Right.
So if we're going to talk about the chicken box in Baltimore, you got to make sure you talk about the jumbo half and half.
Of course.
Andre, our engineer, is throwing his fist in the air and smiling across the glass.
Yes. So where's your favorite place to get your chicken box?
It used to be the Roost up on Ricestown Road.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Haywood. Everybody in Baltimore knew that was the spot to get the best fried chicken box at. But here lately, I live in Baltimore County now, and believe it or not, it's hip-hop on Liberty Road, right across, right above Old Court.
Oh, yeah, right.
Probably one of the best places, and you can still get your chicken box and your jumbo half and half.
Awesome.
I will continue to listen to you guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. That was great.
One of the sad things, I do love chicken, fried chicken. One of the sad things is that it is not the healthiest thing on the planet to eat.
Right.
Which is why I try to switch up when we do eat it. Now, my wife doesn't like eating chicken, period, but I will. But I bake my fried chicken, you know, and you can use some of the old-fashioned Southern recipes, but you bake it and you do your little magical stuff with your flour and put it in buttermilk and put it in the fridge overnight for 24 hours, then take it out and bake it, and you don't know it's not fried.
Mm. You're going to have to slip me that recipe later.
Let's go back to the phones here while we have time at 410-319-8888. Tom in Mount Vernon, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I'm going to make chicken. I like to talk about how to eat it.
Oh.
What I like to do is I'd like to take a corner of a thigh or a drumstick, dip it in a piece of mashed potatoes, and dip it in the gravy, okay? And then take a big bite out of it. And then that juice that runs out of the corner of your mouth, take back your right hand and smear it off.
Oh, this is detailed.
It's really detailed.
And you smile.
And then you smile?
Yeah.
Before you swallow or after you swallow your food?
Sometime during that, I guess. But, like, you got to get that little bit of juice coming out of the side of your mouth. And you take it back your right hand and smear it off.
Tom, thank you so much for that. Dr. Psyche, when he was forced, what would you say to him?
I think it's all in how anyone wants to enjoy it. I mean, you know, I'm very clear to say to people when I am ordering chicken, I need it to be cooked really, really hard. I don't like jiggly wiggly chicken. I grew up like the first caller. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, but my family's from rural Virginia, And when we would come down home for the in the summer, my mom did the same thing, and I talk about that extensively in building houses, you know, how she would, I was up early while she was frying chicken. And then, you know, partly as much, the other thing we didn't talk about, Brittany, is so much of this was about race and class, mm-hmm. was also about economics. I mean, my parents had three children, and, you know, primarily one person working, and so it was also about affordability.
Right.
You know, as much as it was about Jim Crow and everything else, and we're talking well into the early 70s, you know, because I was born in 65, so we're talking about well into the 70s that these this practice continued, similar to what the first caller said. So it's an enduring legacy, I think, and
right.
it does well to recognize all of, as Mark, you said earlier, those complexities, taste, economics, race, region, geography,
mm-hmm.
all of that, the boundaries and limitations, as well as gender.
So I think what we're going to have to do is a much longer show here on chicken and fried chicken. There's too many people calling in. There's a lot here to talk about, both seriously and in terms of our
right.
what we like. Hank just called in and leave a message saying, Hank, that it was a hack and a really interesting guy who does really good stuff. He said, hip-hop is nowhere near as good as Sonny's on Greenmount Avenue. So there we go. So
yeah, those were tied for first when we did the
Sonny's
poll.
Sonny's and
hip-hop chicken. So hip-hop fish and chicken, yep.
Sonny's is good.
Sonny's is pretty good. The honey sauce, which is like, it seems like it's a mixture of honey and hot sauce. It's really good on the wedges.
So you didn't just write the article. You were trying this out.
Yes, I was trying it out. I had to describe the flavors. Do my own form of research there.
Tough job.
Yes.
410-319-8888. Fred, you're on the air line too. Very quick thought. We're almost out of time.
Yeah, quick comment. It covers both African traditions and American traditions. Best fried chicken, especially the chicken breast cooked with the bone in, which is a real art in itself, is Versace's on 25th Street right off of Charles Street.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Nigerian place, but they cook absolutely the best fried chicken in terms of crisp on the outside, tender and juicy on the inside, and flavorful.
On 25th Street?
Yeah, right around the corner from Safeway. It's called Versace's. That's Vasachy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I have not been there. I haven't checked it out. Yeah, right,
I guarantee it. It's the best. They can cook it with the bone in, and that's the art. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. Do we have time for one more quick thought from a listener? Do we? All right, Al, you're on the air. Very quick thought as we go out.
Okay, real quick. I'm from Philly, and I used to work for Trailways. They used to call Trailways the Chicken Bone Express. Right.
Yes. Williams Worsen talks a lot about that.
Okay.
Thank you. What
we enjoy chicken, though. And thanks for the history.
Thank you so much, Al. Psyche, you have a quick closing thought here for us?
Excuse me. I got choked up listening. excuse me. But, the Chicken Bone Express, that's part of the folklore. If you follow the trail of chicken bones, you will know the routes that African-American people traveled. That's what he's referring to, and that's part of the folklore. And so even as today, many African-American people are ridiculed and still around fried chicken. We saw this with the Obama presidency and so forth. I think folks would do well not only to enjoy their chicken, but to also understand and appreciate the enduring legacies that African-American people have had with that yard bird.
So we will come back to this and have a much longer conversation about chicken, and because clearly people want to have fun with it, and it's also an important subject as well to talk about our legacies. So you just heard Dr. Psyche Williams-Forsen, who wrote the book Building Houses Out of Chicken Legs, Black Women, Food, and Power. She's also associate professor and chair at American Studies at University of Maryland College Park. And as Brittany Brito just said, it is a really good book, a really good, great book, who wrote the article Unpacking the Chicken Box, the story behind Baltimore's carryout staple for the Sun, which inspired this conversation. So Brittany and Psyche, thank you both so much
for what
you do and for coming on today.
Thank you.
We'll come back for a longer conversation. And thank you all for calling in and writing in and being part of this program and making it what it is. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from Town Creek. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. And our intern is Michael Dixon. Engineer is Andrea Melton. Theme music by Will Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. Share with your friends by visiting us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voicing community, enjoy your chicken. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.